Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And Ross Douthat is my first guest today, one of the two conservative columnists at the New York Times, along with David Brooks, and at 29 years old, the youngest person ever to get a column at the Times. You may remember that during the presidential campaign last year, Douthat was much quoted for the book that he co-authored with Raihan Salam called Grand New Party, How the Republican Party Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. It was a critique of what Republican conservatism had become, as much as a way to revive it. So here we are with a historic health reform debate about to climax in D.C., with working-class Americans deciding what they think, and 10% unemployment in the face of new record bonuses on Wall Street. So let's check in with Ross Douthat and get his take on some of this. Hi, Ross. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks so much for having me.
Part of your book last year was about how the Democrats' plan to help working Americans is to move toward a European welfare state, while the Republican plan is to do nothing. And you found neither approach satisfying. So on the health care debate, are both sides playing out your script in Congress right now?
To some extent, yeah. I mean, I think that there's, in a sense, there's reason to be a little bit more optimistic on both fronts. I think that the fact of the Democratic majority, the fact that you have the Democratic Party in power pushing universal health care plans has actually stimulated conservatives and Republicans to a little bit more creative thinking on health care than you saw in the waning years of the Bush era. There have been some actual somewhat intelligent plans for a sort of market-oriented universal health care floated by Republican members of Congress, and there's been a lot of activity on the wonkier side of the conservative movement and think tanks and op-eds and so on that's actually advanced the debate to some extent and created some at least somewhat plausible alternatives to the Democrats' plan.
Well, that's interesting that you're saying that the Republicans are participating in this at all, because I want to play a clip of Harry Reid, the Senate majority leader, obviously Democratic leader in the Senate, from yesterday, that seems to say exactly the opposite.
I believe that the Republican leader and all of his colleagues, with the exception of a couple there, one of whom is Senator Snowe, and there are a couple others, want to do anything that they can do not to have a bill.
So are the Republicans really in the debate, or are they just trying to block a bill with the exception of Olympia Snowe?
Well, I think you need to distinguish between the debate and the negotiations. I think Reid is right. The Republicans, by and large, are not in the negotiations because they've decided that, not implausibly, that whatever emerges from the Democratic side of the aisle is going to be something that a small government free market party probably can't support. That doesn't mean, though, that they aren't in the debate. And I think that that's an important distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Just because the party isn't going to sort of be at the table and say, well, we'll give you our votes if you cut $50 billion out of this bill or if you change the subsidies structure in some sense, doesn't mean that there isn't intellectual activity going on.
So how do you think?
I don't want to overstate it, though, by the way. I mean, I think that, you know, the overall mood of the Republican Party is still pretty hostile to actual policy ideas. And overall, I wouldn't say, I think we're still a long way from being able to say there is a Republican plan that if you voted Republicans into the majority, they would push through, that would be effective.
Mm-hmm.
I just think we've come a little further on that front than where we were 2 years ago.
Where are you on the Baucus Committee version of health care? Are you in the cure is worse than the disease camp or something short of that?
I think I'm in the cure is worse than the disease camp. I sympathize, though, with people who are inclined to vote for it, because it does do something real, which is provide coverage to millions more Americans. The problem is, one way to think about it is that the American healthcare system is heading over, it's like the Titanic heading for an iceberg or a barrel going over a waterfall, you know, pick your metaphor. And essentially what the Baucus bill does is ensure that in the period before it goes over the waterfall, the system will become slightly more equitable and slightly fairer to people who don't get employer-based health insurance and to people with pre-existing conditions. That isn't a small thing. The problem is that the more rearrangements you do now, the harder the deeper structural reforms become further down the road.
Are you talking about exploding costs as the waterfall or something different?
Both. Yes, I'm talking about exploding costs, and that's exploding costs both for individuals and for government. For government, the biggest problem, obviously, is the long-term trajectory of Medicare and Medicaid, which just eat a larger and larger share of the federal budget and of GDP as a whole overall. But then for individuals, it's rising premiums. Healthcare gets more expensive for government. It also gets more expensive for individuals. And the Baucus bill and there's been a huge debate this week because the insurance lobby released a study arguing that the Baucus bill would drive up premiums for everybody. And the study was flawed in a lot of significant ways. And in fact, there's reason to think that for people who participate in the system that the Baucus bill sets up, people who are in the individual market, who get government subsidies, who go into these exchanges, premiums might not rise as fast. They might go down. They probably would go down, at least in the short run, because premiums are so high in the individual market right now. The problem is that's still not the majority of Americans. The majority of Americans are still the employer-based system, and there, I think it's pretty clear that their premiums will continue to go up and may go up faster. And that's what's happened in Massachusetts, which is the place that's done the closest thing to what Washington is thinking about doing. They got a huge dent in the number of people uninsured. It's down to like 2 to 3% of Massachusetts' population. But premiums in the state are now going up faster than anywhere else in the country.
Interesting. Although that study was from the insurance industry itself, which is, of course, self-interested.
The study on the future of Baucus care was from the insurance industry, but the data on Massachusetts is universally agreed upon.
And my guest is Ross Douthat, New York Times columnist. And here is a clip of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi supporting public option, government option for health care that she wants to compete, that many Democrats, especially in the House, want to compete with the private insurance companies. And she says the insurance industry was completely disingenuous, warning about rising premiums when trying to stave off the public option, which would be there ostensibly to put price pressure on the insurance companies. Here's Pelosi.
When you think of the campaign that has been launched against the public option by the insurance company, because they can't take the competition, they just can't take the competition, and that the public option should still be in the 60s and well over 50%, it's quite remarkable.
So how close are you to Speaker Pelosi, at least on that point, and through the working class lens with which you what you cover primarily in your book and what you write about a lot, do you think that working class Americans don't want that option to compete with the health insurance companies who they often find themselves doing battle with, even if they are insured?
I mean, I think that most Americans have a pretty hostile attitude towards insurance companies. I think if you go into those polls, it's pretty clear that most Americans don't know what the public option is, don't understand what it does, and so on. But I don't think it's unfair to say that it has at least some degree of popularity. And I think that the Democrats who support the public option do have a consistent long-term vision of where they want the system to go. The public option, some Democrats will deny it now, but it really is a Trojan horse towards universal single-payer health care. And universal single-payer systems are probably more sustainable than what we have now. There's some debate about that, and costs are going up in Europe and Canada as well, but they do a reasonably good job of holding down costs. The problem is they hold down costs, one, at the expense of innovation, but two, by having much, much higher tax rates. And you end up with what one economist I think has called a pocket money society, where, you know, the government lets you keep money for sort of incidentals, but the big ticket expenditures are all controlled by the state. And I think that liberal vision is a plausible vision, but it's one I think that a lot of working class Americans would oppose. The problem is, on the conservative side, there isn't right now a long-term sustainable vision for the healthcare system.
We have a few minutes left. I want to touch a couple of other things. First, on kind of the big picture as you see it for the Republican Party, your book and a few others last year pronounced the death of a generation of American conservatism. And, of course, we saw the Republicans drubbing in November for these big Democratic majorities in Congress and President Obama. Is the party beginning its comeback in a meaningful way, in your opinion, either in the leadership or at the grassroots? Is it the Tea Party movement? Is that just a fringe wacko right? Or how do you see that?
I mean, I think there's real energy in the Republican Party right now, and I think that the Tea Party movement reflects that. I think what happens over the next couple of years, though, will determine whether we look back on this as sort of like the Democrats in 2003 to 2005, when, you know, you had a sort of anti-war left, you had a really energized base, and then as things went bad for George W. Bush, that turned into a movement that captured the country, or whether the Republicans are where the Democrats were, say, in 1980 to 82, when also the party was energized by the first couple of years of the Reagan presidency, and the Democrats made big gains in the 82 off-year elections. But the long-term, the Democrats didn't have a long-term structural answer to what Reagan was saying, and so they ended up with Mondale and then Dukakis and, you know, and 10 years in the wilderness. I think the Republicans are going to do very well in 2010 running against Obama and the Democrats and really defending the middle class from, you know, premium increases and
not if they're just sniping and offering and running against something with nothing, right?
Well, I think in 2010 they can make it a referendum on some of the things, especially if the economy hasn't improved dramatically. They can make it a jobs-based referendum on the radical changes the Democrats are making. I think that works in 2010. It probably doesn't work in 2012, 2014, and beyond.
Yeah. How do you see the big banking bonuses and Dow 10,000 at the same time as unemployment is hitting 10%? Does it make you mad? Is it a redistribution of wealth?
I mean, it's hard to say because this is the thing with the trajectory of the economy is that unemployment is always a lagging indicator. So in a sense, you want to root for you're rooting for the Dow to rise because it's usually a leading indicator and unemployment goes down and so on. The danger, though, is that we are entering a period where we sort of have long-term structural unemployment even when growth returns. And that's an issue that I don't think either party really has an answer to. I personally don't have a definite answer to, but that could be the sort of underreported right now problem of American politics in the next 10 years. It could turn out to be that we'll be stuck at 7% unemployment and nobody will know what to do about it.
So what's it like for you to be a conservative columnist at the Times? Do you feel like a token or a product of ideological affirmative action, or how would you put it?
No, I mean, I try not to feel that way. I try not to feel, and I don't think that the Times would want me to feel like a, you know, sort of explicitly conservative token. I have a certain set of ideas that are generally right of center, and I try and write about them. But I don't think it's healthy or productive to think of yourself as the conservative voice on an op-ed page. I think it's more productive to think of yourself as a voice on the op-ed page, hopefully with a distinctive opinion.
If the Times is a liberal institution, maybe it's the nature of liberalism that it would embrace diversity, and you and David Brooks are products of liberal open-mindedness. I don't see liberal columnists in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Post or the Washington Times.
To be fair, the Wall Street Journal does have Thomas Frank, who is the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, and actually in an extremely, you know, I mean, he's about as far left,
fair,
actually, as any major newspaper columnist.
Did William Safire give you any advice before he died about punditizing for the Times audience?
He did not, although I occupy right now what used to be his library. So I have a vast collection of word books, thesauruses, vocabulary books, and so on the wall. So I know that anytime I'm in search of a word, I can reach up and take one of these books down, and the spirit of William Safire will provide it.
We're doing a series all this week and next on words in the news with a lexicographer. Can you give us an example of one, or even a word you may have a question about?
No, you can't put me on the spot like that. I don't have a good one, and anything I pick will just sound stupid.
He can solve the healthcare crisis, but can't come up with a word.
I didn't say I can solve the healthcare crisis either.
Ross Douthat, New York Times columnist and author of Grand New Party. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC.